Chapter 12. Kuniyuri. A quote from Anonymous, the third revelation of Ganis the Blind. Skies are upended, poured as milk into the tar of night. Cities become pits for fire. The last of the wicked stand with the last of the righteous, lamenting the same woe. 144,000 they shall be called, for this is their tally, the very number of doom. A quote from an Anani proverb. Know what your slaves believe, and you will always be their master. Summer, 20, New Imperial Year, 4132, Year of the Tusk, the Ischjuli Plains. She made love to him, draping her framed hair, which was so blonde as to be white. They despised each other, but their passion was oblivious, and so did not suffer. Her final cries brought the servants scurrying in alarm, even as her thrashing cracked his loins asunder. Afterward they even laughed at the commotion, and as the drowsiness overcame him, he thought it was not such a bad thing for a man to sound a woman without heart or scruple, so long as she was his wife. He did not pause to ask why she had seduced him. Perhaps there will be peace between us, he thought, slipping to sleep. Except that he remained awake, somehow, impossibly. Through closed eyes he watched her, Aeva, his wife of 7 years, scurry naked to the cabinet across their spare room, and produce a filter, which she considered with an expression hung between terror and gloating. She turned to him, her face thin and cruel. "How she will weep," she growled, "the filthy whore! And I will see it and savor it, the breaking of her heart when she learns her beloved prince has died in his wife's arms." He tried to call out as she leaned above him, holding the black tube with medicinal care. But he was sleeping and could not move. "But you will not die, my heroic husband? Oh, no! For I will fall upon your corpse, and I will wail, 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 claiming to the bull heavens that you demanded to be buried rather than burned, like a non-man." He had tried to spit the foul liquid she poured between his teeth. He tried to reach up and out, seize her pale neck. "Oh, my husband," she cried in a whisper. "My dear, dear husband, how could you not see the grudge I hold against thee? But you will know it soon enough. When you are delivered, when you are beaten and broken, then you will know the compass of my spite." Cold trickled into the back of his throat and burned. And at last his slumbering form answered, the alarm screeching through his soul. Drusus Akamian shot upright, gasping and sputtering, swatting at the after-image of another man's treacherous wife. Gone was the ancient bedroom. Gone was the drowsy light of afternoon. But he could taste the poison all the same. He spat across the dead grasses, sat clutching his temples, incredulous and reeling. Nau Kayuti. He had dreamed he was Anasarimber Nau Kayuti. And more. He had dreamed not the experience, but the fact of his ancient assassination. What was happening? He turned to Maimara, who lay motionless beside him, beautiful despite the squalor of her skin and clothing. He recalled their fateful declaration the first and only night they had lain together.
"You have become a prophet. A prophet of the past."
Never had he seen the like, not even in the darkest of Seswatha's dreams. They had crossed paths worn by herds of elk, vast swathes of grassland, veined by innumerable trails, diverging, crossing, forking out to the limits of their vision. As gouged as they were, the scalpers could not but whistle, their souls' eyes straining to conjure a herd whose mere passing could so mark the earth. The ground moans at their approach, Zungus told them that evening. Apparently he had seen the elk herds during his days as an imperial tracker. Even the skinnies flee. But this. They had spent the morning climbing long lobes of land, piled one atop the other, a range of flattened hills. They paused to recover their wind when they finally crested the summit, only to find it stolen by the vista before them. The wizard's first thoughts were of the great Carathay, that the drought had transformed the Ustuli into a northern desert. But as his aging eyes sorted through the distances, he realized he was gazing across another trail, one far greater than the braided immensities left by the elk. "The great ordeal!" he called out to the others. Something clutched his throat, thinned his voice. A horror, or wonder he could not feel. That was when his eyes began picking out the points of black, scattered all across the landscape, that bowled out before them in swirls of dun and ochre. The dead. A battleground, Akamian realized. They had happened upon a battleground, one so vast it would take more than a day to cross, even with their quickened limbs. "A battle of some kind?" Galien called, as if reading his thoughts. "Not a pitched one," Zongas said, his almond eyes little more than slits as he peered northward. "A running battle, I think. They're dead skinnies along the entire length of the trail." "The true contest was to the north," Cleric said, peering. Images from his dreams assailed the old wizard. In the early days of the first apocalypse, before the coming of Mog-Pharao, the ancient hosts of Cunieri and Eorsi had left trails such as this whenever they marched through Shrank lands. "A hoarding," he heard himself say. He turned to address the small crowd of curious looks. "A mobbing like no other. This is what happens when you fight your way through an endless accumulation of Shrank." "Now we know where all the skinnies went," Pakwas said, a great hand raised to the back of his neck. "Aye," Galien said, nodding. "Why chase scraps when a feast marches across your land?" The company passed the first clutch of Shrank within a watch of its downward trek. At least 100 of them, their skin withered to hide, their limbs jutting like sticks. Zongas had difficulty estimating when they had been killed because of the drought. "Dried to jerky," he said, gazing across the blackened remains with a practiced eye. Soon they were in the midst of the battlefield, a thin file wandering across trammeled dust that was barely whiskered with grass, a barren as vast as the horizon. They saw vultures feuding, crows probing eye sockets, wolves and jackals loping in wary circles. They saw figures burnt to charcoal, little more than stumps jutting from sandblasted to glass. They saw bodies hacked to the ground, tangled lines and arcs of them, and in his soul's eye the old wizard saw the battle formations that had shaped them, the hard-armored men fighting beneath banners drawn from across the three seas. They saw what looked like the remains of pyres, broad circles of gutted black. Maimara, crouched to the dust, fetched a wire circumfix from the sand. The old wizard watched her tie the leather string, then loop the thing over her neck. By some perverse coincidence, the symbol fell directly across the koray that lay hidden against her breast. Everywhere the old wizard looked, he glimpsed the stain of sorceries, Gnostic rather than anagogic. To the practiced eye, the difference was plain, as if the world had been gored with razors instead of bludgeoned with hammers. Maimara once told him that Kellis had largely honored the ancient mandate monopoly on the Gnosis, granting the secret knowledge only to the witches, the Swayali, as both a promise and a goad for other schools. So whenever he glimpsed some Gnostic residue, he could not help but think of his erstwhile brothers, and wonder why he no longer seemed to care.
"Skinnies!" Sarl cackled from somewhere behind him. "A mobbing like no other! Think of the bales!"
The captain said nothing. Cleric said nothing. Both walked as if the scene about them were interchangeable with any other landscape, as if mounds of dead surrounded them no matter where they walked. But the others crane their looks this way and that, pointing to various sites of grisly interest.
"He marches against Golgotharath," my Mara murmured, from the old wizard's side.
"He slaughters Shrank."
"What do you mean?"
"Kellis, you still think him a fraud?"
He swept his gaze across the strewn carnage.
"That's for Ishwal to answer."
Ghost moved in him, ghosts of who he had been. Once, before his exile, he would have celebrated fields such as this with hoots of exultation, tears of joy. An aspect emperor marching against the consult, bent on preventing the second apocalypse. The old him would have laughed in derision had anyone suggested he would live to see such a sight. Laughed at the desperation of his longing. But there was another ghost in him, a memory of who he had been mere months ago, the man who would have been aghast at the sight, not because he did not pray for Golgotharath's fall. He did with a fervor only a mandate schoolman could know, but because he had wagered the lives of innocents in a mad quest to prove the faith of millions wrong, and a lunatic barbarian, a skilled Vendi, no less, right. What had happened? Where had this man gone? And if he was gone, what did that make of his quest? He turned to scrutinize my Mara, gazed long enough to spark a curious frown. She was right. He realized this as if for the first time. The Kiri. Flies had inherited the earth. They crossed fields of detritus, threading the hillocks of dead, stepping over dried-out puddles skinned in cracked blood. Lines and blots of interlocking corpses reached out to knot the distances. Skin tied about grinning skulls. Innumerable hands with sunken palms, fingers drawn into claws. A thousand poses corresponding to a thousand deaths. Thrown, struck spinning, flailing in fire, all of them lying inert and breathless in the pools of inky shadow. The reek was overpowering, a melange of rot and feces. The wind raised it, powdered them in it, yet they did not care. The captain called a halt. They prepared camp. The sun scorched the western horizon. Nearby hundreds of Shrank had been piled, for some unknown reason, forming a heap that had been dried into a kind of grisly deadfall. Stripped to his loincloth, Cleric climbed to the summit, his bare feet cracking rib cages like crusts of snow. The sight of him, a non-man burnished in the bronze and copper of sunset, standing upon the compressed remains of Shrank, struck the old wizard with peculiar force. He sat gawking at my Mara's side, fumbling with things half-remembered. Cleric stood with regal inhumanity, his skin gleaming as if greased. "This war," he began. "This war is older than your tongues and nations." The old wizard found himself wondering where the gruel of rotted memory would lead the non-man this time. Would he speak of far antiquity, the first apocalypse? Or would he speak of times when the five tribes of men still wandered the wastes of Iana? Would he reveal his true identity? Akamian lowered his gaze, stared blinking at his hands, at his scab knuckles, at the grime darkening the whorls of his skin. How long had it been since he last asked this question? When had he forgotten to wonder?
"Men bled here," Cleric said from his macabre summit. "Men leaned shouting into their shields."
How long had it been since he had last cared? Even now he could feel it welling within him. Defeat and disillusion. A knee-cracking resignation. And a voice whispered within him, his voice, asking, "What is there to care about?"
"So frail, so mortal," the ancient Ishroy continued. "Yet they cast themselves before the scythes of happenstance, yielded their souls to the perversities of fate."
All the world seemed a burnt-out pyre, All the glory gone, roaring into the hiss of failing coals. All the hope twisting into smoky oblivion. "Dogs, scavenge!" the nonman called. "Wolves chase the foaling mother, the aged and the weak. Even the lion shies from clawed prey. Only you and I know the madness that is war. Man and non-man, only we pursue what lions flee." And who was he, Drusus Acarmian, to think he could grapple fate, pin her to the floor of his hateful aspiration? "We die for what we know," the nonman boomed. "And we know nothing! Generations heaped upon generations, tossing lives after self-serving guesses, murdering nations in the name of ignorance and delusion." Siswatha? Was that who he thought he was, the incarnation of an ancient hero? "We call our greed justice. We call our soiled hands divine. We strike in the name of avarice and vanity, and the—" "Enough!" the captain shouted at a high, shining figure. Aside from cleric, he stood alone, wind-whipped and insane. "Some wars are holy," he grated, in blood-raw tones. "Some wars are holy." The non-man regarded him from his summit, blinked once before turning from his furious aspect. He climbed from the heap, shrank, making a stare of heads and torsos, then leapt to the dust with leonine grace. The shadows of the dead crowded his naked legs. "Yes," he said, drawing his shoulders back to stand tall. "Enough." The sky darkened. The reek of dust and death tumbled through the air. The non-man reached for the leather pouch where it lay against his bare hip. "Yes," something cried within the old wizard. Something that had leaned forward with his own shoulders, flooded his mouth with his own spit. An affirming urgency. "Yes, this is all that matters. The worries will go away. They will go away. And if not, clarity will come. Yes, clarity. Clarity will come. The clarity needed to honestly consider these questions. Come, come, old man. Out of the muck." Animal spirits inhabit every soul, which is why a man could attend to one thing while remaining vigilant for another, why he could converse with his neighbor while lusting after his wife. In that moment, cleric was all that existed. And Cariol, wild and dark, and yes, even holy. The word upon which creation's own prayer seemed to turn. The nail of heaven gleamed across his scalp, a crown that only the hundred could bestow. And it was as proper as it was inevitable, for he ruled the way the moon ruled the tides, the way the sun ruled the fields. Absolute, as a father among his children. One by one he ministered to the sitting scalpers, and Acarmian watched, leaning in envy and anticipation. There is closeness in ritual, there is touch. There is an intimacy that approached coupling, an iron faith that the nearing hands would not strike or throttle. Acarmian watched the near-naked form loom above Maimara beside him, watched her raise her lips in eager acquiescence. The blackened finger slipped along the shoot of her tongue, pressed deep into her mouth. She went rigid, pulled her shoulders back in bliss. For the first time he noticed the bow of her belly. Pregnant? Was she pregnant? But— "Yes," his soul's voice cried, "simplicity. You need simplicity to honestly ponder complications." Cleric loomed over him, his shoulders brushing the violet clouds, his face blank with inhuman serenity. Acarmian watched his finger, still glistening with Maimara's saliva, dip into the fox-mouth opening of his pouch. A delicious moment, magical in the way of small miracles, the little pins from which all life hangs. He watched the finger reappear, tip blackened as with soot. Ashes. Kujara Kimwa. My Mara, pregnant? Who are you? Yes, honesty, simplicity. Raise your lips. Yes. The finger rose before him, its tip a tingling black. The old wizard bent back his face, opened his mouth. The next time you come before me, the hated voice called out over fawning masses, you will kneel, Drusus Akamian. Kellis. A coldness smoked through Akamian. The finger hesitated. He raised his eyes to the Naaman's black, glittering gaze. Kellis. The Aspect Emperor. No, the wizard said. No more. She falls asleep, troubled by the wordless uproar of the evening. Her own half-hearted attempt to refuse the Kyrie the previous week had occasioned little more than curiosity, it seemed to her. Who knew a woman's fickle ways? But when the wizard had refused, a strange species of alarm had gripped the company. Dread prickled the silence. She could sense the scalpers watching at angles to their eyes. Wariness quickened their movements, as they went about otherwise thoughtless tasks. The captain especially possessed the air of waiting.
Akka, she whispered in the dark. Something is wrong.
Many things are wrong, he replied. His voice clipped. His eyes fogged with turmoil. He was at war, she realized. I've been a drunkard before, he muttered, but not to her, it seemed. I've even hung from the hooks of the poppy. Momentary clarity sparked in his eyes. The burden that mandates schoolmen bear, many of us are compelled to seek low pleasures. At war with the earthly residue of Kujara Kimwa. Her fear is a novelty to her, so long have her passions slipped into oblivion at the merest distraction. She struggles to keep hold of it, but she is too weary. She drifts into unsettled sleep. She dreams of kilages, of white throngs, scratching through the black. She dreams that she runs with them, the Shrank chasing her own waifish figure ever deeper into the earth. A cry awakens her, grunts an earth's scuffing struggle. She blinks, sucks waking air. The sounds are near, very near. Dawn rims a blackened world. Two figures crouch over the wizard. The captain and cleric. What? The wizard kicks and pedals. What are you doing? She asks with bleary curiosity. No one acknowledges her. The wizard gags, jerks, and struggles like a landed fish. What are you doing? She cries. Heedless, she scrambles to her feet, throws herself across the Nonman's hunchback. He shrugs her away. Hold her! The captain barks at shadows standing in the dark. Calloused hands clamp about her wrists. Galien, restraining her from behind.
There, pretty,
he grunts, dragging her back. He twists her arms against the small of her back, thrusts her to her knees. She hears herself howling in fury. No! No! All she can see of the wizard is his legs kicking. Crude laughter slouches from the dark. Sorrow. A hand closes about the back of her neck. Her face is slammed into the dust. The wiry remains of weeds. Other hands seize the waist of her breeches. She knows what comes next. But the captain has turned from the struggling wizard, sees what has happened to her. He flies to his feet, savagely kicks one of her unseen assailants, stabs another. She sees Wunnard stumble, kicking to the dust. The hands vanish as she finds herself on all fours. Touch her, Lord Cossiter grates, to the unseen shadows behind her,
and your soul is forfeit.
She glimpses Wunnard, convulsing, puking blood into his beard. She scrambles forward with the instinct born of desperation. She seizes Squirrel from her meager belongings, draws it, retreating, trips over the beehive carcass of a shrank. Dawn is but a corona of slate and blue across the horizon. The night sky rises black and infinite, oblivion littered with countless stars. The scalpers are naught but hunched shadows, their heads and their shoulders stuck in pale starlight. They approach her, wary and weaponless. Akamian screams.
No!
She shrieks.
Stop! Stop!
The captain draws his blade. The rasp draws chills across her skin. He strides toward her as if she were nothing more than wood to kindle. Light soaks the horizon behind him, renders him black. She can see the murderous glint of his eyes beneath his hood of wild hair. They seem to glow for the black lines tattooed about them.
"What are you doing?" she cries. "What madness is this?"
Her voice cuts the back of her throat. Such is her terror. This is how it happens, she realizes. The brothel taught her as much. But she has forgotten in all the intervening years. Your doom always outruns you. You grow complacent, fat in the company of peace, then awaken to find all safety, all hope, overthrown. The air is windless, chill. Lord Cossiter lunges at her. He hacks with a violence that notches her blade, wrenches her wrists. She retreats. She is quick enough, skilled enough to parry his strikes. She is trained. He sweeps and swings his broadsword, brings it clanking down. His cast noble braid swings like sodden rope. With a kind of wonder, she realizes that he isn't trying to kill her. The future towers dark and shrieking in her soul's eye. Images of torment and violation, of brutalities only scalpers could commit. Her cries become a wail. She throws herself at him, fighting the way her brothers have taught her, nimble and light, pitting craft against strength. He grunts in surprise, swatting at Squirrel. He relinquishes a single step, a hoary shadow thrown onto its heels. Gold bursts across the horizon. He sidesteps, leans, angles his shadow to her side. Sunlight crashes into her squint. She blinks, hesitates. Her sword spins from fingertips she cannot feel. A fist of stone strikes her to the ground. It's happening, she thinks. After enduring so much, surviving so much, her death is happening.
Akka!
She gasps, stumbling back. Sunlight splices her tears. Blood runs hot across her lips. And nothing happens. No hand clamps about her throat. No knife pares away her rags. Out of instinct, she falls motionless, breathless. The judging eye, which had remained sealed for so long, opens. And she sees them standing in a ragged arc, demons on the plain, their hides charred, the hair of their few redeeming deeds, the only light threading them. And the darkest, the most fearsome by far, lies directly before her. Kneeling. The captain.
Princess Imperial,
it croaks, glaring from eyes of fiery tar.
Save us from damnation!
I am Anna Serimba Maimara, she cries. Princess Imperial, daughter of the Holy Empress, wife-daughter of the Aspect Emperor himself. On pain of death and damnation, I command you to release the wizard.
They have Akamian bound and gagged, trussed like a corpse about to be raised to the pyre.
You are the apostate, the captain says. A runaway.
They have her sword. Poor Squirrel.
No! No, I am on a...
They have her Kore, the tear of God.
Foolish girl. Did you think your disappearance went unnoticed?
They have her.
You presume?
You presume to command me? You are a captive. Thank your gods you're not more.
And she recalls as much as realizes that he is completely unlike her, that in soul and sentiment he is as alien as the Nonman, if not more. There is a wholeness to him, a singularity of act, aspect, and intention. She can see it in his look, in his face, the utter absence of warring pieces. For some reason this calms her. There is relief to be found in futility. She knew this once.
So what? You're going to bring me back to Mother, then?
His gaze is strayed from her to the dawn. Crimson light illuminates his face, paints the wilder strands of his beard in tones of blood.
We march to the coffers. Same as before.
Why? What has my father commanded? He draws his knife, begins shaving the calluses about his fingernails.
Why? She cries. I demand you tell me why!
He looks up from his trivial labor, gazes with a flat intensity that sets her thoughts quailing. He has always frightened her, Lord Cossiter. The threat of violence has always kindled his manner. For him, atrocity was simply one more thoughtless faculty, one more base instinct. Kindness, she knows, is missed to him, something not entirely real. The honed edge is one of only two boundaries he respects. The other is faith. Faith in her mother's husband. Even after running so far, deep into the savagery beyond the new empire's rim, she remains caught in the Aspect Emperor's nets. And knowing this has made the captain even more fearsome. The thought that he is Sadunyani. She does not ask again. She rifles through the wizard's satchel, finds only 5 sheaves of parchment. The writing across them illegible, for some river soaking, evidence of the Kyrian that, she supposes, and a small razor, scabbed with rust, which she conceals beneath her belt. She wants to weep as they resume their course. She wants to scream, to run, to scratch out the captain's eyes. She slouches instead, stares at her feet for as long as boredom allows. She avoids looking at the scalpers, consigns them to her periphery, where they seem at peace with the desolate plains, little more than leering shadows. She feels naked now that she is known. They keep the old wizard bound and gagged at all times. When they break for meals, either Galien or Paquas remove the gag while the captain dandles a core, whether his own, or the one he stole from her she does not know, before the old wizard's face. Akamian avoids any glimpse of the trinket, invariably looks down to his right instead. He says absolutely nothing, even with his gag removed, presumably because Lord Cossiter has told him that any sound, arcane or mundane, would mean his instant death. Periodically the thick fingers holding the core stray too close, and the wizard grimaces at the salting of his skin. After several days a patchwork of scabs and pink skin web his face above his beard. He reminds her of an ascetic she once saw burned alive in Carathuzel, when she was still young enough to feel terror for others. The shrial priests had marched the old man through the streets, decrying his heretical claims, and bidding onlookers to come witness his fiery cleansing. Where Akamian wears rancid furs, he wore putrid rags. But otherwise they seemed so alike that her gut flutters at the recollection. Knob-knuckled hands bound before them, gags to stop the danger of their voice. Wild hair and beard, wiry and gray, and the distant look of men condemned long before the thugs had seized them. The old wizard stares at her from time to time, a strange look, ragged, at once hopeless and reassuring. They have always shared an understanding, it seems. One as deep and cold as clay and earth. They have both been broken over the knee of fate,
and as different as their lives and catastrophes have been, their hearts have sheared along similar lines.
"Be calm, girl," his eyes seemed to say. "No matter what happens to me, survive."
Without fail, his looks make her think of the razor hidden beneath her belts. She only hears a commium when he's gagged. On the afternoon of the first day, he begins roaring at the captain through spit-soaked cloth, shrieking with such guttural fury that the man pauses in his approach, nostrils flaring, eyes glaring with lunatic intensity. He screams about his own retching. The captain remains as imperturbable as always, simply gazes and waits until the wizard's maniacal ire subsides. Then he cups his palm and cuffs the old man to the ground. My Mara glimpses the smiling look exchanged between Galien and Pakwas. Each night they forced Kiri upon him. She receives her measure willingly. Kull hunches alone in the dusty grass, watches them with dead eyes. She cannot remember when she last heard his voice. Did he even speak Shaik? The stone hags no longer seem real. She prays that Soma still follows them, that a skin spy might save her. But she had no way of knowing. The captain now forces her to practice her daily indignities in plain view. The other scalpers, Galien and Pakwas especially, regard her with forced indifference. They gambled on their lust, thinking the wizard her only protection. Now, their intentions reveal, they behave like pious thieves, like men wronged for wronging others. They sit and eat without speaking. Aside from the rare hooded glance in her direction, it seems they look only to their hands or the horizon. The mutinous air that had festered ever since Kilajus has become gangrenous. The expedition now seems more a collection of warring tribes than men bound to a singular purpose. She finds herself stranded with the captain and cleric. The first few nights she lies awake, plotting possibilities more than actions. Her body aches with sensation. The bruising ground, the prick of grasses, the tickle of fleas climbing her scalp. She can see Squirrel jutting from the beggar's bundle that is his pack. She can sense both her Koray and the captain's beneath his tunic, dark little twins suckling oblivion. She guesses at his slumber, only to be disabused time and again. He invariably lies on his side, his head cradled on a raised arm, but just when she thinks he has fallen into the arms of Orosis, he raises his head and lies rigid, as if probing the surrounding black with his ears. Once she even begins crawling toward him, her thoughts a mad tumble of terror and mayhem.
"Grab your sword," her thoughts cry through the tumult. "Grab your sword, cut his throat."
But she glimpses his hand slide to his waist as she continues her feline creep, sees his fingers settle upon the grime-blackened pommel of his broadsword. After that, she decides he never sleeps, at least not the way humans sleep. They rarely speak to each other, cleric and the captain. They almost never address her. For the entirety of their journey, a part of her has wondered at their relationship. The captain's advantage seems plain enough. A scalper's kill is a scalper's profit, and she can scarce imagine a killer more formidable than cleric. But what could induce a non-man, an Ishroi no less, to submit to a mortal's will? Even a will so preternatural as Lord Cossiter's. She fixates on this mystery, even becomes jealous of it, thinking that at the very least this one question will be answered. But as the days pass, she watches them from their very midst. The relationship becomes more enigmatic, if anything. A week into the wizard's captivity, she is awakened by the sound she finds inexplicable at first, until blinking, she spies cleric sitting cross-legged on the far side of the captain's slumbering form. He weeps. She lies motionless across the hard ground, feeling the stamp of flattened weeds through her blanket. She battles a sudden terror of breathing. Cleric sits, with his arms stretched across his knees, his head hanging so low that she can see the sinews roping the back of his neck, the humps of his spine. His breath is dog rapid, hoarse deep. He moans, a sound as bottomless as Kil'Aj's. He mumbles or murmurs, words she cannot decipher. Random tremors seem to fly through him, afflicting first this hand, then that shoulder, as if the ghost of some bird battles to escape him. A sense of heroic melancholy seems to emanate from him, as onerous and grand as the ages that have birthed it. A sorrow that would crack a human soul.
"Cossidor," he rasps.
This is the first time she has heard Cleric refer to the captain by name. It prickles her skin for some reason. The captain draws himself to a seated position opposite the nonman. She can see only the man's back, the play of starlight across the battered lines of his split hauberk. Funneled down the center of his back, his hair hangs in a tangle about the rope of his cast noble braid. She already knows that Cleric's sanity is not a constant thing, that it ebbs and flows according to its own disordered rhythm. But she has only guessed at the role played by the captain. A shudder passes through the nonman's frame.
I struggle.
Good. There is an uncharacteristic softness to the captain's voice, one born more out of greed for secrecy than any tenderness.
Who are these people?
Your children.
What? What is this?
You are preparing. The nonman lowers his bald head back into shadow.
Preparing? What is this tongue I speak? Where did I learn this tongue?
You are preparing.
Preparing?
Yes. To remember. Cleric raises his face to the grim figure sitting before him. Then, without warning, his black gaze clicks over the captain's shoulder, finds my Mara where she pretends to sleep.
Yes, the white lips say, full in the play of blackness and starlight. They remind me.
The captain turns to follow his gaze, reveals his savage profile for no more than an instant before turning away.
Yes, they remind you of someone you once loved.
Lord Cossidor stands, shouldering the light of the stars, then draws Cleric into the windy dark. This exchange alarms her, but more like news of growing famine overseas than any immediate threat. She recalls Akamian's description of nonmen erratics, how their memories of mundane life fade first, leaving only archipelagos of spectacle and intensity, the confusion of a soul hanging without foundation, and how the redemptive memories gradually follow, stranding them more and more with disconnected episodes of torment and pain, until their life becomes a nightmare lived through mist, until all love and joy sink into oblivion, become things guessed at through the shadows cast by their destruction. This, she realizes, this is the prize the captain has cast upon the balance of their transaction. Cleric yields up his power, and Lord Cossidor offers him memory. Men to love. Men to destroy. Men to remember. And yet Lord Cossidor is Zordunyani, one of her stepfather's fanatics. Why else would he protect her from the bent lusts of the others? And if he is Zordunyani, then he would never deliver his expedition into destruction, unless his Aspect Emperor has commanded it. The deal he has struck with Incarial, she realizes, could be a false one. If so, the captain plays a most deadly game. Like all of the few, she is accustomed to ignoring her arcane sight. But Cleric bears his mark so deeply, the residue of ages of sorcerous practice. Occult ugliness blasts him, the scars of his innumerable crimes against creation. Add to this the sheer beauty of his mundane form, the contradiction, and it sometimes seems as if the merest glance will pry her eyes from their sockets. Even if she had not seen him warring through the sewer depths of Kilauseus, or beneath the clawed bowers of the Mayorn wilderness, she would have known he was a power. A great power. If he were to choose to annihilate the skin-eaters, only a Commian could possibly hope to stand against him, were he free to speak. The company continues its lonely walk, dwarfed by the confluence of never-ending land and sky. What features the landscape possesses are slavish and melancholy, as if they were mountains beaten into ruddy heaps and long wandering flanges. Wild clouds feather the sky, slow-sailing immensities that promise rain that is never delivered. She often gazes into them when she walks, probing the precipices and plummets, wondering at the way they form floating plates that seem to wheel in competing directions, pinching deep glimpses of blue into white oblivion. The wizard stumbles along, bound and gagged, glaring hate at everyone save her. Survive, my Mara. Forget me. More days pass before she is able to piece things together. Sarl especially provides her with pivotal insights. He tells her how Lord Cossiter, famed for his cruelty and martial zeal, had come to the Aspect Emperor's attention during the Unification Wars, how he had been promised a special shrial remission by none other than her uncle, Mathanet, for founding a scalper company and remaining in the vicinity of Hunoriel, where he could regularly check on the wizard.
"He is born of hell," the madman tells her, his face squished into I-knew-it-all-along glee. "He's born of hell, the captain, and he knows it. Oh, he knows it. He thinks your Gerwicka there will pay his toll."
His squint pops open in mock alarm.
"Deliver him to paradise!"
"But how?" she protests.
"Because of him," the madman cackles. "Him!" The Aspect Emperor knows all.
She herself has seen the yield of the wizard's 20 years alone in the wilderness. After a Commian absconded from Marrow, she found her way past his slaves and broke into his tower room. Part of her had expected to be blasted, to die screaming in sorcerous fire. She could sense the residue of something arcane, but there had been no incipient wards protecting the room. Nothing. Because of his slaves' children, she knew. At first she could see little save the sunlight outlining the shuttered window where she had first seen him. The smell was rancid but curiously dry and inviting. Finally she saw the wolf pelts warming the walls and ceiling, the crude-hewn bed, and then the issue of his decades-long labor. Pages scattered, stacked into teetering piles. Scrolls piled like bones tumbling into shadow. Dream after dream, scratched in ink and numbered, everything numbered. Pattern after pattern, theory after theory. Siswatha this, Siswatha that. A hoard of details she could never hope to decode, let alone remember. Out of all the scribbles she peered at, only one would live on in her memory. What seemed the old wizard's final entry— the one that would spur her to pursue him. "She has returned. Of all people, I am awake at last." "She," he had written, "she, Esmanet, mother." If she could simply walk into the old wizard's room, my Mara reasons, then so too could her stepfather. She can even see him in her soul's eye, the Aspect Emperor stepping from a point of blue-white light. She can see his face, always so remote, always so terrifying, slowly scan the slovenly gloom. What would a god think, she wonders, looking upon the low belongings of his old teacher, the obsessive issue of his wife's first abiding love? Nothing human, she is certain. She laughs in the course of these ruminations, loud and hard enough to draw more than one questioning look from the others. Part of her blames the Curie, which she adores, even as she hates. It continues to leech her soul, to draw water from her previous concerns. Now and again she even catches herself thinking her captivity an honest and advantageous trade, so long as Cleric continues to plumb her mouth with his cool and bitter finger. But the humor is real. From the very beginning she had dismissed the old wizard's fears regarding her stepfather. "This is the way he sends you," Akamian said. "This is the way he rules, from the darkness in our own souls. If you were to feel it, know it, that would simply mean there was some deeper deception." She had discounted him with a smirk, with the grimace she reserved for fools. She, an Anna Sarimba by marriage, who had lived in his divine presence, who had even sat riven, skinned in goose pimples, as her stepfather merely crossed the room. Like so many, she confused absence with impotence. The Endiamine Heights seemed so distant. Now she knows. The Aspect Emperor transcends distance. Anna Sarimba Kellis is everywhere. Exactly as the old wizard feared. With this realization comes a new understanding of her power. She finds herself scrutinizing the captain, guessing at the warring scales within him, the precarious balance of piety in bloodlust. She represents an infuriating complication, Maimara decides, the wrinkle marring the long silk of his ambition. He feels no worldly terror, she decides, because his fear of damnation eclipses all. Too warlike to find redemption in the gods of compassion, too miserly and too cruel to secure the favor of war or the hunter. Only the Aspect Emperor. Only he can make virtue out of his bloodlust. Only he can deliver him to paradise. She is the variable, she thinks, remembering the algebra she learned at the knee of Urajaman, her Nilnameshi tutor. She is the value he cannot calculate. What Lord Cossiter does, she finally decides, depends on what he thinks his lord and master, his god, desires. "I am with child," she tells him. A flinch passes across the implacable face. "Are you not curious?" she asks. His glare does not waver. Never has a man so terrified her. "You know," she presses, "don't you?" She has spent her life, it seems, staring into the faces of bearded men, guessing at the line of their jaw, feeling their hair chafe the bare skin of her neck. She has childhood memories of barefaced priests and caste nobles in Sumna. Some of the older Nanser who populated the imperial court still clung to their womanish cheeks. But it seems that for so long as she can remember, men meant beards. And the more they adorned them, the higher their station. Lord Cossiter looks little more than a cutthroat to her, a beggar even. "Think of him as that," she cries wordlessly. "He is less than you. Less!" "Know what?" he grates. "Who the father is." He says nothing. "Tell me, Captain," she says, her voice pinch shrill, "why do you think I fled the Endiamine Heights?" Even his blink seems a thing graven, as if mere flesh were too soft to contain such a gaze. "Why does any girl flee her stepfather's home?" she asks. The lie is a foolish one. He need only guess at the length of her term to realize there is no way she could have been impregnated in Momon. But then, what would a man such as him know of pregnancy, let alone one born of divine violation? Her mother had carried all her brothers and sisters far beyond the usual term. "You understand, don't you? You realize what I bear?" "A god. I carry a god in my belly." It seems she need only tell herself this for it to be true. Another gift of the Curie. And she sees it sparking in his eyes. Wonder and horror both. She almost cries out in jubilation. She has cracked his face. At last she has cracked his face. His lunge is so sudden, so swift, she scarcely knows what has happened until she slams across the turf. He pins her. His right hand clamps her mouth, so large it all but engulfs the lower half of her face. A kind of wild monkey rage shines from his glare. He leans close enough for her to smell rotting teeth.
"Never," he says in a roaring whisper. "Never speak of this again."
Then she is free, her head spinning, her lips and cheeks numb. He turns away from her, back toward the watching non-man. There is nothing to do, it seems, but to sit and weep. Despair fills her after this last foolish gambit. These were scalpers, implacable. These were the kind of men who never paused to reflect, who asked questions of women only so that they might show them the proper answer. Even without the Kyrie, they were forever trapped at the rushing edge of passion and thought, believing utterly what they needed to see their hungers appeased. Where some were set aflutter by mere suspicion of slight, nothing but outright calamity would throw these men back into themselves. Only blood, their blood, could incite them to question. What was for these men was. Lord Cossiter was a fanatical agent of the Aspect Emperor. Drusus Acamian was his prisoner. They marched to plunder the coffers. If they were caught in the wheels of some greater machination, then so be it.